Good morning. The sermon scripture, 1 Corinthians 13, finishes with the words, "Faith, hope, and love endure, and the greatest of these is love." Before I begin, I want to offer a truly heartfelt thank you to all of you for inviting me to speak here today and for having this service in the first place. I'm guessing that for many of you this isn't a personal issue, and your willingness to learn more and to honour people of all genders gives me faith in the power of communities to change society, hope that children who express gender diversity will be supported and will grow up in a more accepting world, and a palpable feeling of being loved, even though I've yet to meet most of you. So thank you. I believe you also commemorate Transgender Day of Remembrance as a community in November. Unlike that day, this isn't a day for mourning. It's a day of empowerment, a time to celebrate transgender people around the globe and the courage it takes to live openly and authentically, while also raising awareness around the discrimination trans people still face. The theme for this year's Day of Visibility is Surviving, Thriving. Those words pretty much sum up the two distinct phases of my adult life, a long period of just about, by the skin of my teeth at times, surviving, and then a seismic shift in my mid-30s that allowed me to begin thriving. I have the privilege of speaking to you twice today, so I'm going to use this first opportunity to give an outline of my life story, and then after lunch I hope to delve into a little more detail on actions that we can take to bring about a society where people of all genders can do more than just survive, but can truly thrive. I was born in 1968. Some of you might remember it as the Year of Revolutions. It came at the end of a decade of sexual liberation when traditional male and female roles were being questioned. And it was also a time when clinicians and researchers and theorists were paying close attention to sexuality and gender and identity. All of this had entirely bypassed my family. It might as well still have been the 1950s for us. I was the third child in my family, born in a small town in southern central England to solidly middle-class parents. My dad was ordained as a minister in the Church of England and was teaching at a fairly conservative theological college. Mum had given up her teaching career to raise a family, a decision she was very happy about and never regretted. When I was born, at home, the midwife handed me over saying, "It's a girl." No one had any reason to suspect she was wrong. In those days, biology determined gender. I was about two or three when I first realized that there was something of a disconnect between how I saw myself and how the rest of the world saw me. I was in the bath with my brother, and my sister was in the bathroom as well. And I remember asking my brother when my body was going to change and look like his. And my sister laughed and said that it wasn't, that I was a girl and that it was going to stay that way. And I distinctly remember feeling really angry with her that she would lie to me and say that I was a girl when it was so obvious to me that I was a boy. Of course, as time went on, it turned out she was right and my body didn't change. But I was still able to be pretty happy in those early years. And my best friend Daniel lived next door. I had friends at school amongst both boys and girls. I was raised in a very loving family. And in those days, it was okay to be a tomboy. It still is. If I'd been a boy, assigned as a boy at birth, but had expressed feelings of being a girl, then my story would have been really different. But even though I was pretty happy, my memories include a huge amount of intense longing to be a boy. I wished on everything that there was, four-leaf clovers, shooting stars, birthday candles, everything, that I would wake up a boy. It dominated my thinking, and it was exacerbated whenever my sense of self clashed with other people's view of me, which happened often. For example, my neighbor had a habit of calling in my brother and his friend by calling out boys, and I would go running in with them and then be hurt and feel angry every time because she would say that she just wanted Michael and Philip. We moved house when I was 8. My dad became minister in a beautiful village in countryside close to the center of England. And I started a new school. And on our first day at the school, my brother and I were both in the same room, and a large crowd of boys gathered around him, asking him what football team, what soccer team he supported, what kind of car my dad had, what games he liked to play, what sports he enjoyed. And I had a smaller group of girls surrounding me, asking me questions that I had no idea how to answer. And this strong feeling of envy of my brother that nobody was asking me those questions that I really wanted to be asked. Every weekend, my brother and I would fight because that same group of children that we met, they would come down to our house. We had a really big garden, and they would come down, and we would have soccer teams that we made up, and we would have little mini competitions. And he never wanted me to be part of that. My parents supported me, and you know, insisted that I was allowed, that I was included, but I never really was allowed full membership into those groups. Although my parents supported me in playing soccer, it was clothes where I had major battles with them, especially with my mum. She was mostly okay with me wearing jeans and t-shirts, but for church, I had to wear a skirt or a dress. But luckily, joining the choir was what actually saved me. The children wore long red robes that reached down to the ground, both the boys and the girls, so I felt okay about wearing a long red dress with a white surplice over the top and a collar. And the men wore the same clothes without the collar, and the women wore a knee-length red gown. So back in those days, I was free to walk the half mile to school and church alone. So I would leave the house ahead of everybody else in my skirt with my trousers rolled up underneath. And then I'd get to the end of the drive and remove the skirt, roll it up and hide it in a bush, and run all the way to church, making sure that I got there ahead of my parents. And then I could be into my gown, and nobody knew what I was wearing underneath, and feel comfortable and okay with who I was. And then I'd just reverse the process on the way home, and the skirt would be hidden in the back of the cupboard until the same battle the following week. So like I said, I had some pretty intense yearning going on, but on the whole, I was a happy and thriving kid at that time. But reaching puberty was pretty much the end of happiness. When I was a younger child, I thought everybody else was crazy for thinking that I was a girl, but now it became apparent that I was the crazy one for thinking I was anything other than a girl. The changes in my body caused me immense distress. And at the same time, I was becoming very isolated. The boys wanted nothing to do with me because I was a girl, and the girls wanted nothing to do with me because I was too much like a boy. By my mid-teens, the problems in my wider life were echoed in my problems in the church choir. The choir director, understandably, wanted me to move to the women's section, and I steadfastly refused. Moving would have meant wearing women's robes, something I simply could not face. As a 14, 15, 16-year-old, I was clinging desperately to the androgyny of childhood while my peers moved on into young adulthood. A compromise was finally reached. I continued to wear the same robes, but I moved to the adult pews. I was supposed to sit with the women, but as those rows were often full, I'd have to sit one row back with the men. And before long, I just sat on the back row whether there was room with the women or not. There'd be an occasional grumble from the choir director, but it was a just about tolerable solution for us both. So there I was, as I turned 18, in June of 1986, unable to sit comfortably in the choir with either men, women, or children, and with an equal sense of discomfort in the rest of my life. Things were moving towards a crisis, and going to university would prove to be the catalyst. I was due to head off to teacher training college 3 months after my 18th birthday, and during that final summer, I made the decision that I would have to try and be what the world kept insisting I was. I set off for the north of England with longer hair than I'd had since I was six, and a determination to give womanhood a try. It didn't go well. By the time I was 19 and a half, I had attempted suicide, been hospitalized for depression, and was living in a substance misuse rehab. Around that time, I went back to visit the village where I'd grown up, and very uncharacteristically for me, I had gone to visit somebody. I was very withdrawn at the time, but I'd gone to visit someone whose children I had babysat for when I lived in the village. And during the course of the conversation in the evening, Bibi asked if there was one thing that I could change in my life that would make me feel happier, what would it be? And without ever consciously having had this thought in my mind, I blurted out, I'd get rid of my breasts, and then sat in horrified, stunned silence, wondering how on earth she was going to react. To her eternal credit, she just quietly said, well, if that's what you wanted, then that could probably happen. You should go and see your doctor. So I went back to where I was living and went to see the psychiatric nurse who'd been treating me. And I reported this conversation to him, and his comment was, I wondered when you were going to realize. Apparently, he had, when he very first met me, had thought that I was probably transgender, but didn't want to put those words into my mouth and wanted me to figure it out for myself. Actually, I had no idea what he was talking about. I'd never heard the term before. You have to remember there was no internet in those days, no role models on television, and I had no idea that there was a single other person in the world that felt anything like I did. Anyway, he referred me to the gender identity clinic, and I was accepted there for treatment. And with the full and wonderful support of my family, I changed my name and began hormone therapy. Within a relatively short time, I'd moved to a new city and I had jumped firmly into the closet as someone who was transgender. I lived as a man, I worked in farming, and I told nobody about my past. And though I was continuing to have surgery, I had a lot of surgery, I lost count, but somewhere near 20 procedures between the age of 19 and 35, I never told anyone the truth about why I was going to hospital. On the face of things, everything was sorted out now. I returned to university, qualified as a teacher with a first-class honours degree. I taught for several years, got my master's part-time, and I moved steadily up the career ladder to become the equivalent of assistant principal in an elementary school. But I was still really only surviving. As time went on, the gap between who people thought me to be widened and the gap between who I was and who people thought me to be widened, and I became more and more lonely and suffered increasingly long periods of anxiety and depression. The periodic front page headlines in the British tabloid press outing someone as transgender left me terrified of being found out and of losing the little security I had. In my mid-30s, I became so depressed I could no longer work, and during the lengthy recovery, I decided to quit teaching, which was in itself becoming increasingly difficult, though that's another story, and to spend 6 months travelling around New Zealand. It felt as though I was stuck in several areas of my life, spiritually, in my relationships, I'd not so much as been on a date in several years, and in my career. So I was determined to take every opportunity that presented itself to move myself forward in those areas. When I arrived in New Zealand, one of the first things I did was go to the Auckland Joggers Christmas Social. It was the usual meal, followed by dancing, and as usual, I stood around the edges, feeling embarrassed and shuffling about a bit. Then someone asked me to dance, and I was about to say no when I suddenly thought, I'm on the other side of the world. I don't know anyone. They don't know me. I'll probably never see them again. I can be one of those people who dance really badly but have a great time if I want. So I joined in. So I joined in probably really badly and had a great time anyway. That feeling that I could reinvent myself and be anyone I wanted stayed with me as I traveled around. And at first I was tempted to tell people I was a deep sea diver or a pilot or something. But I began to feel more and more strongly that what I really wanted was to be myself. I eventually found the right time and the right place to tell people about my past, and I found the results from that were really good. The friendships I formed were very deep and honest in a remarkably short time. So I started thinking about why I had never told anyone in the UK. I'd always had these solid practical reasons about how if I told one person, I'd have to tell everyone, and then anyone new who came along would have to know at some point, and I'd end up being defined by being transgender. But once I actually started telling people, all those reasons fell away, and I realized there'd been a smokescreen for the real reason, which was simply that I was ashamed of who and what I was. I'm going to talk more about that sense of shame and where it came from after lunch. But to continue with my story, I decided that I'd sooner have deeper friendships with those people who were able to accept me as I am than have possibly more friendships but less meaningful ones. In the summer of 2006, I stood in front of a gathering of about 40 friends from my mountaineering group and told them my story. And guess what? Every one of them was totally accepting of me. A year later, I returned for another 5 months to New Zealand. I still had a lot of work to do before I could be described as thriving. This time, I began exploring both personal relationships and spirituality. Through some amazing experiences, I came to realize that a person's gender identity, gender expression, or sex assigned at birth is irrelevant to me in terms of attraction. What I look for in a person is their personality. And in January of 2007, I was working at a guest house when Arnie came to stay. I needed a ride to my van, which was in a garage way down on South Island. When Arnie offered to take me, I jumped at the chance, both to get to know him better and also for the chance to learn more about Judaism, which had already begun to intrigue me. By the time Arnie left to return to the US, our first date had lasted 3 weeks, and within a month of me returning to the UK, I was on a flight to Detroit to visit him. As our relationship deepened, I spent more and more time in the US. I finally moved over here on a student visa with the aim of becoming a school counselor. It took me several years of learning about Judaism before finally deciding to convert. I wanted to be sure I was making the decision for me, not because my partner was a rabbi. Once I had converted, though, I was keen to share publicly my joy in becoming Jewish, and an adult bar mitzvah seemed the natural way to do so. In September 2010, I stood before the congregation of Shir Tikva in Troy with my parents and sister present, along with a number of colleagues from the school where I'd begun working part-time, and chanted Torah. I could end my story here, having reached the point of becoming an American bar mitzvah boy. In every aspect of my life, I was thriving, but there's a little more to add. Arnie and I have since married, and I'm now working full-time at an amazing private school. Coming out is a continual process, and when I began at the school, I came out to the director, who encouraged me to tell my story to the staff. I did so, and after the meeting, one of the teachers came up to me and said, "I think my child might be transgender." The child was 3 at the time, and since being able to speak, had been insisting he was a boy. I've had the enormous privilege of supporting that family and their child as they came to understand what was happening and to the realization that they needed to allow him to transition to be himself. Most recently, I came out to the entire school community during an educational evening on what it means to be transgender, so that between us we can create the most welcoming, safe place possible for gender expansive children. And guess what? Pretty much every single family contacted me to express their support. That 3-year-old is now 11, and while I don't want to minimize the challenges he faces, I know his longing to have a body that matches his self-identity is just as strong as mine ever was. At least he's been able to live socially as a boy, and he won't go through the agony of puberty, as he'll have access to medical treatment as and when it becomes necessary. Being able to support him has felt like a completion of a journey, and it marks the completion of this part of my talk. I've been extraordinarily fortunate in receiving unconditional support from family and friends, and I've experienced very little discrimination. I want to acknowledge that this is all too often not the case, and after lunch, I'll be sharing some general information about gender identity, along with some current statistics, and the reasons why this kind of event is so important. Thank you.